ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! This Working Life on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
China is playing a peculiar role in this Iran conflict.
Yes, Geraldine, it may be an economic superpower, but could it also be emerging as a global peacemaker?
Does it even want this role?
Is China benefiting from an increasingly unstable and erratic United States?
Or does it dread the disorder? I'm Geraldine Doo.
I'm Latika Burke, and this is Global Roaming.
You know, Latika, last week when all the drama came about Trump talking about civilizational erasure and so on and so forth, I had to go on radio with Waleed Ali, our colleague, and he said, where did the Pakistanis come from in all of this, you know, all of this discussion? And it suddenly occurred to me then, of course, they're much more linked with China.
Mm.
And you suddenly saw from no discussion the sense that China was there behind the scenes, and we're now learning quite a lot more than we once knew. And quite where this heads is what we're trying to focus on today. Xiao Xian, who's the Chinese ambassador to Australia, spoke at UTS in Sydney way back in March, foreshadowing some of the attitudes that I think we're starting to see emerge publicly from China, talking about their economic position. But also, when asked about what China's role might be in settling the Iran conflict, just listen to how he puts things.
It's a war that should not have happened and should not be continued. For the United States and Israel to attack Iran, which is a sovereign state, and to kill its leader, that's an action. That's a violation of the UN Charter, international law, international rules. And secondly, it's creating tremendous chaos in that region to regional, even global economy. And both China and Australia, we're kind of feeling already the side effects of that situation. So our approach is that we need to have an immediate stop of the war and a peace negotiation between the two sides. We'll continue to engage. We send our special envoy to that region to talk with relevant parties to see what we can contribute.
Really, this is the big question of our time. How the rivalry between the United States and China shakes down is how our futures will be determined. So it is so relevant and vital that I think we look at this in the context of what's taking place in Iran and what kind of role China envisions for itself.
Yeah, and, you know, they apparently don't see things in that zero-sum game way that the West tends to. If you lose, I win, you know. And they just do think more slowly. Now, I know we read that, but it's hard, I think, for a Western mindset to fully grasp. But I tell you, the man who can help us understand it, I think, very well, is our guest today, Rana Mitta. I'm absolutely delighted to say, a highly respected observer of China, who happened to supervise Kevin Rudd's doctoral thesis, by the way, just as a little bit of extra information. He holds now, after 23 years at Oxford University, the S.T. Lee Chair in U.S. Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he may be well known to listeners as the author of a classic book, Forgotten Ally, China's World War II. Here he is now. Rana Mitta, welcome to Global Roaming.
Great to be here with you, Geraldine and Latika.
So I'm really keen to hear how you think the Chinese are viewing this extraordinary turmoil in the Gulf. They clearly got involved in bringing Pakistan into that role. And Wang Yi, we heard, made phone calls, the Chinese foreign minister, to advance discussions. And now where are we? How do you think they're seeing it?
I think that China is trying at the moment to tread a difficult path between being on the sidelines, at least publicly, because it doesn't want to seem to have its fingers over any of the, I think, probably quite unsatisfactory solutions that are likely to emerge soon, but actually putting a pretty heavy pressure on various participants behind the scenes. I think it's certainly the case that the end goal from China's point of view is to get back as much as is possible to a stable Gulf, one where actually the alliances, or no, they're not really alliances, but partnerships that China has made over the last couple of decades essentially provide a stable environment for the free flow of energy and also the geopolitical influence that China would like to operate in the Gulf. But at the same time, China doesn't really want to get too involved in having to take sides. Bear in mind that China for a long time has managed to be pretty friendly with Saudi Arabia and with Iran, and with the United Arab Emirates, and actually to a reasonable degree with Israel as well. Losing that ability to be able to talk to everyone is what they fear, and that's why they're being a bit cautious, but behind the scenes, I think, quite clear about where they want things to go.
Do we know what China thinks about Iran acquiring nuclear capability?
What they do worry about very considerably is instability, or worse still, kind of, you know, devastation caused by war in areas that they consider economically vital. And if the nuclearization of Iran led to the nuclearization of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi has made it very clear that they would almost certainly build a bomb if the Iranians did, then that creates new and very significant instability in a part of the world which still provides, you know, huge proportion, I think over 50% of China's energy needs. So that instrumental reason for Iran causing a nuclear escalation in the region would worry them. But in terms of general principle, I think they wouldn't, you know, actively support it, but I wouldn't have thought that they would consider it to be the world's worst crisis from their point of view either.
Rana, the fact that the US is so, let's say, tangled up at the moment in Iran, is that seen as a sort of quasi-victory, you know, effectively a victory by default for China, or don't they see things like this?
I think victory is a bit too strong. I think there's no denying that China looks at what's happening in Iran right now, and basically the sort of I mean, as we're speaking, it's kind of a stalemate. There's a blockade that the United States has put on the day that we're speaking. Obviously, Iran itself is continuing to inhibit shipping from coming through the Straits. So China looks at that. It sees that the United States is now very, very occupied with trying to unknot a problem which, you know, of course, it co-initiated just a few weeks ago. And that's not bad from China's point of view. They would like, I think, in a general sense, to feel that the United States was constrained in its capabilities around the world, that contrary to what we've heard, particularly since January with the, you know, the Venezuela raid, the Maduro raid, that the US is not simply unconstrained in its ability to use its power around the world. So they're pleased about that. But I do think they also find a lot of cause for concern in the idea that the world is going to become more unstable. Now, this might sound a bit counterintuitive because, of course, instability provides opportunities. But actually, China in many ways is a very, very cautious regime. It's highly authoritarian, extremely autocratic at home, you know, repressive of rights, all the things that we know. But it doesn't really like nasty surprises, or surprises that it thinks are nasty from its point of view. I think it will have seen the way in which the US has used power, not just in Iran, but also Venezuela, the threats over Greenland and so forth, and realized that one of their assumptions from last year, and I've talked to a few Beijing think tankers about this, one of the assumptions they made last year was that whatever else, you know, you say, you could take to the bank, the Trump administration was basically quite isolationist. It was quite keen on getting out of the wider world. And actually, from what some people say, that may be true of some members of the administration, possibly the vice president, J.D. Vance, who I think is very open about the fact that he really, you know, there was this in the New York Times article just the other day in which it was reported as him saying, look, I'm not very keen on these wars. But that doesn't now appear to be the view of the president of the United States, and he's the decider. So China will have looked at that and I think felt that actually this provides a sort of uncertainty and instability in what's happening in the world. Don't get me wrong. China definitely wants to reconstitute global order to make it much more amenable to Chinese preferences and desires, much more about economic growth, much less about individual civil liberties and human rights, let's say. But it wants to do it gradually, from the inside, using the existing structures and reorienting and repurposing them. It doesn't want to blow up the whole thing and see what happens. You could say that Russia might be more in that sort of position. It's a more nihilistic power in some ways. China is not nihilistic. And for that reason, I think where the Americans are now in Iran worries them, because they can't see the end point any more than the rest of us can. And they really want to know what happens next so they can plan. And right now, I suspect they feel that they can't really plan.
Rana, you're speaking there to a predisposition of adaptation and opportunism. Are you saying that China may not have the ability to be as opportunistic as they could be to exploit on the absolute fracturing within the alliances between the United States and its friends over things like NATO? Or do you think they will learn in time and get there?
I think that's a very astute way to think of it, Latika, the idea that they may find limitations on opportunism, because to have successful opportunism, you need to have actually some level of certainty about the wider atmosphere. I think I would come back at it at a slightly different angle, which is to say that right now China has a variety of simultaneous pressures, internal as well as external, that it has to navigate at the same time. And any further variables, unpredictable variables within that grouping are bad from its point of view. So just to give one very clear one, because we haven't mentioned it at all, and I think actually it's really the thing that, I might guess, is Politburo members in China wake up every morning and think about first, which is China's internal politics and economics. They're not unstable, I think, in the sense that I don't think there's a kind of huge overturning brewing or anything like that, but they're not in good shape. The economy is definitely not firing on all cylinders, hasn't been really since COVID. Youth unemployment, this is the thing that really, when I talk to economics think tankers based out of Beijing and Shanghai, that comes up over and over again. The situation is bad that way. There's also a lot of internal turmoil. Something like tens of generals have been purged from the Chinese military, including four, I think, out of the six members of the Central Military Commission at the very top level. So these are circumstances that suggest that, in a sense, China would like a bit of time and space to sort out its domestic issues. And if the rest of the world could be nice and stable and give them a massive global trade surplus and just keep chugging along while they sort out things from Beijing, that would be very kind, thank you. It has to be said that the President of the United States...
We all know the feeling, Rana.
Well, we do. Well, the thing is that let me give you both kind of fear and hope on this. On the one hand, the President of the United States does not appear to have calming down the world in a general sense on his agenda. Put it this way, I have no idea what people in Havana have planned for a couple of weeks' time, but I wouldn't book any holiday weekends. Let's put it that way. On the other hand, there is a sort of oasis of calm, potentially, in the middle of this hurricane. And that, counterintuitively, may be the US-China relationship. Because as things stand now, if things don't alter again, we are expecting there will be the long-awaited, somewhat delayed summit between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, the two presidents, coming together in Beijing, probably on May 15th, something like that. That's assuming that things have calmed down enough in Iran for that to be plausible. But that's the basis they're working on at the moment. There's lots of different signals on lots of different things about this meeting, and we don't know where they'll go. But it does look as if there's going to be two main themes that come from it. One, they both begin with T. One of them is tariffs and trade. Well, that's two T's, I suppose, where I think that both sides are going to try and get to a sort of détente, to use a Cold War phrase, not on nuclear weapons in this case, but basically on trade policies. And I think that both sides essentially have thought that last year was a bit too much of a roller coaster. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, and Holly Fung, the sort of Vice Premier on the Chinese side, have been talking about these issues, it would appear, and that's sherpaing, I think, for where that will go. There's also discussion about the other Taiwan. But the indications seem to be that the Chinese are really going to push hard for new language from the Americans, particularly language that suggests that the US might be more amenable to Chinese intentions to unify Taiwan with the mainland. But I don't think there's any suggestion that certainly in this year that this is going to be tied up with an immediate military campaign. In other words, sort of wisdom that was being heard for a little while that, America's distracted by Iran, China might just go and nab Taiwan while no one's looking. Actually, I don't think seems to me a very likely outcome from these talks. So it may be that after all the business of the last 10, 15 years, US-China relations, at least for a year or two, ends up being much calmer than the rest of the world. And that, of course, also gives Beijing breathing space to decide what they want to do next.
Rana, on Taiwan, I have been wondering the last few weeks if Xi Jinping is not looking now at Russia starting a war it can't get out of, the United States starting a war with Iran it definitely thought it would be over well and truly before it has been declared a ceasefire. If Xi actually looks at that and says, wars are very difficult to end once you start them. As opposed to that orthodoxy you were talking about, which was that this will incentivize bad guys to do more authoritarian things and grab land.
I think that's definitely going through the minds of senior people, or the ones who haven't been purged anyway. I think other things are going through their minds at the moment. I think there's a two-prong strategy on this. First of all, I have little doubt, I don't think anyone who looks at China has any doubt, that preparations are being made such that China could be in a position to launch a military campaign to take Taiwan if it chose to do so, probably within the next year or two. Now, 2027 is a date that's been given. That's partly symbolic because, as I'm sure you remember, Latika, the Red Army was first founded during the Nanchang uprisings of 1927. I don't think any of us were around at that point, but, you know, it's the point of reference. But it doesn't have to be exactly 100 years, obviously, but it's in that zone. And we can see on everything from kind of aerial raids in the skies over Taiwan to the building of amphibious vessels, there's a whole variety of things that China's doing that could help it in that direction. Nonetheless, I think it's been clear for a while that if it has a choice again, using other non-military means of pressuring Taiwan are going to be much more to China's taste. So, you know, in the week that we're speaking, the president of the opposition, main opposition party in Taiwan, Kuomintang KMT, Zheng Liwen, has just been, you know, meeting Xi Jinping, essentially. Now, quite what this means in terms of Taiwan policy, you know, you can fill in some of the blanks. And she would still have to get elected as president in 2028. And whether meeting Xi is going to, you know, serve that aim or not, the Taiwan's voters will have to decide. But the point is that clearly is a pathway which, whatever you think of it, is about trying to negotiate with an entity inside Taiwan rather than firing missiles. So that's a different sort of pathway. Economic coercion, as you and Australia will know very well, is something the Chinese are extremely capable of fine-tuning. And Taiwan has already been hit over occasion with like pineapple exports, chemical and paint exports, various things that are not existential unless you're growing pineapples. But nonetheless, a reminder that if we want to cut off your trade routes, we are in a very good position to do that. And then there's the sort of the midway, the gray zone stuff. Do you have a naval blockade but not an actual invasion? You know, these sorts of things are war-gamed on both sides the whole time. So all that being the case, I think something perhaps slightly counterintuitive might be happening at the moment, which is not that China thinks, my God, we're in a hurry, we need to kind of get this Taiwan thing sorted out, but rather time may be on their side and it's worth waiting to get a result that will be easier to do. The key factor, and that's why this summit matters, is what does the United States really intend in terms of defending Taiwan? Is it the United States that provides, you know, many billions of dollars of arms to Taiwan, which is still very real? Or is it the United States that maybe really wants to get a trade deal going that will boost the economy and might not think of Taiwan as being so central to its overall purposes? We just don't know the answer to that yet, but there are a lot of people in Taiwan and elsewhere who are really keen to find out the answer.
Actually, there's some very interesting commentary in a recent article by a woman called Zong Yuan Zoe Liu, saying precisely that actually all of this drama with Trump has heightened Beijing's concerns about what sort of United States they might face should they make any decisions around military invasion of Taiwan. That in fact, it's made them more risk averse, less potentially likely to take risks because of what they're seeing. You're leaning to that, are you?
I think that's a really useful insight. And again, if I may give a shout out here to Zoe Liu, who is one of the most insightful analysts of Chinese politics and economics, is operating out of Washington, D.C. to today. Anything she writes is very, very well worth reading. And yeah, she makes in that article in Foreign Affairs, I think it's in the current edition, well worth reading again, a counterintuitive point, but it's really worth making. And that point is, this is her point, not mine, so I will not claim credit, but I will rebroadcast it. just because something damages America doesn't automatically mean it's good for China. And there is a somewhat, you know, sort of automatic instinct, particularly in the last few weeks and months, to say, oh, X has happened. You know, for, it goes both ways. Like, they couldn't, you know, they managed to render Maduro out of Venezuela. That's bad for China. And I'm like, I'm not sure about that. I mean, you know, my counterexample would be, well, China still has the contracts. I think Huawei has the contract for cloud computing in Venezuela, which is probably more valuable than, you know, the presidential palace as such. But the flip side is also true, which is that, you know, in the situation with Iran at the moment, where the US is currently in a sort of stalemate, may yet be solved, may not, we just don't know at this moment. Is that good for China? Well, it's shooting up gas prices, you know, oil prices around the world. It's creating, well, just to give one example. In Western Europe, inflation is rising even higher than it is in the United States because of the energy crisis. Western Europe is both a place which is a major market for Chinese goods, and it's also one of the places where there's tech cooperation in terms of products like electric vehicles. A Europe that is more financially strained, which is now, you know, also very nervous about whether it needs to be spending more on defense because NATO may be, you know, all these things. These aren't actually good for China at all, because China's dependent on a strong, prosperous, confident Europe that's happy about doing deals and trade with China. Right now, that's not at all where Europe's mind is.
How are they viewing this Straits of Hormuz, for instance, at the moment? You know, the quintessence of disorder, no easy resolution, at least doesn't seem so to me. Do you think they'll try to play any sort of role there?
I think that they are playing a role right now, but it's behind the scenes. Everyone, I think, believes that when Pakistan brokered the agreement that brought that kind of lightning round of negotiation, you know, the 20 hours in Islamabad, that China was essentially behind the scenes at Pakistan. Pakistan, you know, seized the moment pretty effectively, I think, but they wouldn't be able, I think, on their own to be able to whip quite all of that diplomatic clout together without the Chinese basically discreetly behind the scenes and saying, you know, you need to get these people in the room. So I think they will continue to facilitate other people doing the diplomacy. But I refer you back to my earlier point, Geraldine. China doesn't want to be in the room because then it might get the blame. So they're quite happy for the Turks, the Pakistanis and others to be upfront on that. More broadly speaking, I would say that, well, to give an example of a direct reaction, I think the Chinese are almost certainly looking much, much more closely at another strait of great concern to them, the Straits of Malacca, you know, much further east, which they've always considered to be their equivalent choke point. Much of their argument, obviously a very self-serving argument about how they need to dominate the South China Sea and so forth, has been about basically preserving shipping traffic in that particular strait. And I think what's happened in Hormuz has been a sort of business school case study almost of what it, or perhaps defense college case study of why it is the Chinese might use that as essentially an excuse, a rationale for doing something similar at some point. The point being, at this stage, though, they would point out they haven't done it yet.
Rana, I didn't expect to feel more calm at the end of talking to you about China today, but I certainly do.
Think of me, Geraldine, as the geopolitical equivalent of chamomile tea.
We will, and we'll let you go with that. Thank you very much indeed, Rana Mitter.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Geraldine. Thanks, Latika.
Thank you, Rana.
So what did you primarily take out of that discussion, Latika?
I think, like you, Geraldine, I sensed a calmness that perhaps we haven't had in the world order when we've been talking about particularly China-US relations, but also as an Australian, China and us relations, China and the world relations. We've gone from a very antagonistic period to one where the United States is going around antagonising everybody, and China, by contrast, is not saying much, and in that there is some kind of calm.
Well, they want to look reliable, and at the moment I would argue that they are looking quite reliable, certainly by comparison with others. But I think that fundamental question that he was putting, that they want the world order to be a world order. They want the US to help run a stable world order, and they're not quite ready. And there's a gorgeous line in this article that I'm, what the Iran war means for China. Beijing fears American volatility. quality more than American power by this Zoe Liu. And as she says, Xi Jinping's sort of getting the United States he's always wanted in a sense, but he doesn't really like it. You know, they don't want to be in the room running the world order. Maybe never, certainly not yet. Now, I think that he just emphasised that again and again, which doesn't mean they're not. They don't want big change, but they want it incrementally. Now, I mean, I just think he emphasised that a lot. And I think for a lot of us at the moment, there couldn't be a better time to hear that.
I also thought the bit that stuck out to me the most was when he was describing the fundamental way that the Chinese are thinking. And you really did understand, I thought it was very crystal clear, that actually maybe they're not as nimble and as adaptive to world chaos as we think and as they could be. Because if you think about how crazy our world is, how our governments are being strained to respond to all the madness that's coming out from the White House, sometimes several times a day, and you don't see that level of responsiveness from China, not publicly. And then you start to think, well, maybe actually their system just doesn't crank into gear as well as we have. Maybe we're actually doing a better job of adapting and processing what the United States is doing and moving with the times.
Now, as always, Latika, we've had some very engaged feedback and we appreciate you taking the time to write to us in the midst of all the turmoil. In fact, Graham has emailed asking why always China? He says, in almost every episode, it seems to come back to what will China do or how will we check China's power? China hasn't invaded other countries as Russia and the US seem to do, which is exactly what Rana Mitter's just said, on a regular basis. China has tried to work with other countries to promote trade rather than impose their will. Just because they have a different system of government, is that why we fear them? Well, that's an open question, Graham. I think, and that's exactly why I think it was interesting to have Rana Mitter, who's been a sort of long-term scholar of China, and certainly was one of the people who really alerted the world to the role that China had played in World War II, saying that we'd overlooked that and that that was a sort of a gap in our understanding. So I think he's one of the people who's really committed to trying to understand more about a Chinese way of the world. Are there others you follow, Latika, who you think are useful?
Oh, I follow a load of China watchers, almost too many. It's one of my life's obsessions. But I would also add to this from Graham, and thanks for writing in, Graham, but I would add we're actually not paying enough attention to China. Trump's one of the drawbacks of the Trump administration is how much attention we're paying to so many superficial things, not obviously the wars and the really substantial things that Trump is doing that are changing the world. But we were actually at a very good place as in terms of coalition countries trying to push back against Chinese economic dominance. And don't forget, China is undergoing a massive military buildup. It doesn't tell us why it's doing that. So I actually think, Graham, we could spend another five episodes talking about what China's doing and thinking, and we still wouldn't have even have scratched the surface.
Okay, so let's hear more from you. global.roaming@abc.net.au, that's where you email us. Thanks to our acting executive producer, Kylie Gray, and producer today, Jessie Kay. Latika, you'll be back tomorrow with Laura Tingle, because Hamish is having a very well-deserved week off, to pore over the results of the Hungary election. Speaking of turmoil, extraordinary result, and the downfall of Viktor Orbán.
Oh, yes, I can't wait for this episode. It's a repudiation of so many things. Populism, Russian interference, and US interference.
Thanks for your company. Bye-bye for now.
See you, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.